This is the Future of HR podcast, episode 91.
One of the companies that I've actually seen pivot to more team-based performance management is Microsoft. Microsoft had this last decade of stockholder returns in performance. They were wired performance management, as majority of organizations are, towards that individualized focus. To your point, JP, what's your outputs? What did you deliver? And then you're going to be rewarded based on that. You and I both know, and I'm sure everyone who's listening to this podcast knows, that is not how work is conducted today. We are not on assembly line anymore, having a very individualized task that really is isolated. Any work that's happening today is interdependent and absolutely happening at a team level, not an individual level. And so Microsoft made a difference in their performance about 10 years ago, where they started asking the question that managers were going to rate their employees on, which was, how did this person's contribution make others around them better? And it became this much more, how are you developing others around you, as opposed to, what have you done for me lately as an individual?
What trends will have the most impact on the future of work? How will AI impact both white-collar and blue-collar roles? Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott, and this is the Future of HR podcast, the only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversations, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career, to the next level. Hey everyone, if you've been listening to the podcast, then you know I am incredibly passionate about inspiring and developing the next generation of HR leaders. But you may not know that I'm also passionate about speaking to and working with HR organizations to enhance their capabilities. In fact, one of the coolest things that's happened since I've launched the podcast is that several HR organizations have asked me to speak about the future of HR and support their efforts to develop their HR teams. It's been an incredible honor to work with these HR organizations, and I'm looking to have an even bigger impact in the future. If you'd like me to speak to your HR organization, or if I can ever be helpful in building the capability of your HR team, please reach out, as I'd love to hear from you. I want to thank this episode's sponsor, Deeper Signals. Deeper Signals is a modern scientific assessments platform that is revolutionizing the way organizations measure, manage, and develop their talent. I'm a big, big fan of their assessments because they accurately assess personality, motivation, and competencies in just 7 minutes. But don't take my word for it. You can try Deeper Signals Core Drivers Assessment for yourself. Go to deepersignals.com/futurepod, that's future P-O-D, and take the Core Drivers Assessment for free. And with that, I want to introduce this week's guest, Dr. Kelly Monahan. Kelly's a managing director at Upwork, leading their Future of Work research program. Her research has been recognized and published in both applied and academic journals, including MIT Sloan Management Review and the Journal for Strategic Management. In 2018, Kelly released her first book, How Behavioral Economics Influences Management Decision-Making, A New Paradigm. And in 2019, Kelly gave her first TEDx talk on the future of work. She's also written over a dozen publications and is a sought-after speaker, and she is the perfect guest to give us data-driven insights on the future of work. In our conversation, Kelly and I will discuss the key trends that will impact the future of work over the next few years, why leaders of the future must shift towards building trust and developing others, why organizations need to shift from rewarding individuals to rewarding teams, why AI will create a skill imbalance where it will create new jobs, but there'll be a shortage of talent to fill these roles, and why the skills-based organization movement is stuck in the theory phase and the challenges it faces in implementation, and much, much more. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode as you listen. Just drop me a line on LinkedIn and say hello. And now let's jump into my conversation with Kelly. Kelly, welcome to the Future of HR podcast. How are you?
I'm doing great, JP. So great to see you today.
It's great to be with you. Thank you for spending time with us and talking about not only your impressive career, but really just this amazing research and knowledge you have of what's going on in today's work, but really where you think work is headed. And so I want to start just talking about your early career, because I was surprised to see that you started in marketing, yet I think you consider yourself an HR professional, IO psychologist maybe. but you started marketing, worked several marketing roles before you made that leap to HR. So tell us more about your experience in marketing and how that's helped you in your HR career, and then why you made that jump to be an HR partner.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you going deep tracks. A lot of people don't realize I didn't start my career in marketing. And it's funny, when I went to RIT and got a business degree and had to pick a major, and I fell in love with a consumer behavior class. And really because it was all around the analytics, around how people were making decisions and ultimately how brands could better engage their customers. At the time, you know, I don't want to date myself, but there was really no people analytics or mature HR function quite yet, especially when it came to higher education. So I actually started my career as a media planner. It was really much the data around what shows people were watching, how many cars were driving by billboards, and what made the most optimized mix of media to engage that consumer. But I remember sitting in my cubicle at the time, looking around, crunching all these numbers, and thinking to myself, this office is so dysfunctional. The way that we are all engaging each other, the way we're behaving, is there a way to bring the same science that we've developed from a consumer behavior perspective to really understand and optimize the workplace and ultimately how humans relate to one another? And so that's why I made the leap into HR, pivoted, went and got my master's much more with an HR focus. And, you know, when I was at the Hartford, I had someone take a shot on me to move me from the marketing department into HR and become a generalist. And I was able to apply a lot of those marketing principles I learned to the field of HR.
That's a really good story, because what's cool about HR is that so many things, other disciplines, we can learn from. We've had people who have, you know, communication backgrounds, have started in political science, right? Economists who then go into HR, because you can apply that to human behavior and how the workplace works. And so I love that you did that. And, you know, I think the other thing we should underline that maybe not everyone realizes in 2024 is that people analytics is still pretty new, right? It was really marketing analytics that sort of, we said, hey, well, how do we take marketing and apply that from a consumer to an employee perspective? And so it's really grown the last 20 plus years.
Absolutely. And I do think it's still, there's so much still to learn. It's funny, like the foundations in theoretical science have been around from an IO psychology perspective for decades, but our ability to make that actually into a practical application from a data-driven perspective in HR, I do think is still a new muscle, at least what I've seen in many HR departments today.
Yes. I mean, it really depends on the maturity of the organization, but there's yeah, a lot of a long way for us to go. And so after your time as an HR partner, you actually joined Deloitte as a lead researcher on the future of work. And then that led to another research-based role at Accenture, Meta, which I always think of Facebook. I'm sorry. Sorry, Mark.
Yes. Oh, yes. Same.
And then now Upwork. So you have effectively been studying the future of work and how we work since 2015. Looking back over that time, like, what has changed about work for you and what has stayed the same in terms of your research?
Yeah, the great question, JP. It's funny, when I went back recently to one of my articles I wrote with Jeff Schwartz at Deloitte back in 2017. And it was, I feel like you could have published it in 2024, and I'm not sure there would have been much distinction, because at the time we said we were foreseeing AI was going to start disrupting the way work was being done, the task itself, and the way that HR had to think about organizing the flow of work. We saw the rise of, at the time when Deloitte was calling off balance sheet workers. You know, now at Upwork, we call it freelancers, contractors, really this rise of the alternative workforce and using that as a way to essentially build agility within decision-making. And then the third thing we wrote about in 2017 was the way that distributed work was on the rise. And essentially, location was becoming increasingly irrelevant for having to staff workforces and actually conduct the work itself. And so we built this whole model on the changing nature of work, workforces, and workplaces. I think the biggest surprise, thinking about this from almost, you know, 8 years later, we're still in the same conversation. I am not sure we've actually moved the needle across those three dimensions to the way when I first saw many years ago. And not just that, you know, I gave a TEDx in 2019, right before the pandemic, and, you know, looking at, again, focusing on how AI was going to start disrupting the workforce. And I think we're starting to see that today, especially with the rise of generative AI, which we can certainly talk about. But the reality is, I think so many businesses today are still in survival mode, still trying to unravel from the many years of the pandemic, trying to understand what is the new customer demand, what is the new workforce model, the right workforce mix they need to sustain themselves in the future. And so I think it's hard for HR professionals, if we're to be honest, having these more strategic conversations. And now we're saying, hey, write a brand new playbook for how to operate in a distributed workforce. You need to redevelop your manager training because we don't have this developed yet. And if you and I both know the tech debt that's within organizations today, and HR data in particular is messy. And so really ushering this promise of AI, I still think is a long runway because it requires so much data cleanup and really recovering from some of the tech debt that we have.
Yeah, lots to unpack there, Kelly. You know, as you're talking back in 2017, you know, talking about, you know, how work is shifting to distributed work, you know, kind of like where we work and how we work is going to shift. But we're still talking about that in 2024, right? And we had, the pandemic shifted us. We had to all shift. And so we made it work. And now you've got the whole return to office and the debate. And it makes me think, I'd love your perspective on this, because I think humans are very agile. We can adapt to what is happening in our environment. And that's why we've been so successful and survived for a lot of years. But human nature doesn't change much. And we're still so much holding on to old paradigms, right? Whether I need to see someone to know they're working, whether it's, there's just so many things we hold on to. And I wonder if you've seen that in your research that, you know, people's perceptions of work and how we work hasn't changed as much as we needed to kind of keep up with the trends and where people want to go.
Yeah, I think you bring up an astute point. So, you know, one of the things we were studying back in 2017 at Deloitte was the rate of change from an individual you just mentioned as it compares to the system. And so to your point, individuals are pretty nimble and agile, but having a system be agile is much longer distance that's required, and it's much harder to move a group of people as it is an individual. And so I think you're absolutely right. We're seeing that dynamic take place today. And we have some research coming out shortly from Upwork Research that we start to look at the generational differences. And I hesitate to go there because I certainly don't want to stereotype generations. But what you just picked on is very true. Like, as we look at existing leaders today and really that Gen X baby boomer cohort, we haven't seen a big shift in the sentiment of work. So to your point, the desire to be on site, the desire to at least have people together in a group to form culture, we still see that being the preference of the letter that existing leaders want to have today. When it comes to Gen Z and millennials, we tend to see a broader sentiment shift when it comes to the way that they're thinking about work and organizing work. And it'll be interesting. In the next couple of years, we're going to have more Gen Z and millennials in the workplace than any other generation. And so will some of these things start to accelerate, like flexibility, as an example, the return to office debate that's happening? It'll be interesting to see when they're at mass. The difference is the people in power and influence within organizations today are still the older generation. And so I think you just see this tension rising. And the one last thing I'll say about this that we're studying from the labor market dynamic, which is really different, we haven't seen in the last 30 years, is we have more job demand than we do supply of workers. And I say that in a little bit of hesitation because so many of my friends today and colleagues are finding it hard to have a job. I think there's a lot of reasons you can unpack why that the case is. But in theory, the power rests more with the workforce today than it has in times past. And I think we're starting to see that dynamic take shape too in a few different instances.
It's really interesting. And you know what comes to mind a little bit are the progressive commercials where people are turning into their parents or middle age. And I'm sorry to say this, but maybe it's because I'm a Gen X and have children, right, who think I'm turning into that person on that show. But, you know, that kind of holding on of like, it's so hard for people who are older to think about this new paradigm. And I do think Gen Z, in my experience, like my children who are 13 and 10, it's a radically different world they're growing up in, on how they use technology and what they're seeing, what they're exposed to. And I think for millennials and Gen Z as well, they are going to want some things differently. But the question is, do they become their parents or not, right? Do they grow up and start to take on the same roles and expect the same things of life stage? Or is there something that fundamentally has happened? And I think we won't know until, you know, 10 years from now, probably.
I love that comparison. And the one thing I would just add to that is I think what's going to be interesting, like when I've done some qualitative research just to interview baby boomers and Gen X to really understand where this mindset is staying, a lot of it is because they have risen up the ranks and built their careers based on a model of success. If success starts to look differently and if Gen Z and millennials start to redefine success, I think that is going to be interesting how HR responds, because a lot of our performance mechanisms in place are still rewarding longevity, rewarding tenure, really having a hierarchical view of a career ladder. And if that's not really the future of work, that has to really be disrupted, and success is going to have to start looking and being measured differently.
Hey, everyone. After a quick break, we'll be right back to our conversation with Kelly. If you are a fan of the future of HR, then you know that I believe the organization with the best talent wins. So how do you ensure that you are selecting and developing the talent that will help your organization to win? The answer lies in using a scientific, data-driven approach to assessing and developing your talent, and that's where Deeper Signals comes in. Deeper Signals is a modern scientific assessment platform that is revolutionizing the way organizations measure, manage, and develop their talent. Why am I such a big fan of Deeper Signals? Well, first, traditional personality assessments are often unscientific, time-consuming, and fail to provide practical and actionable insights. But Deeper Signals is different. It's built on 50 years of psychological research and powered by advanced machine learning. Deeper Signals provides HR leaders with insights and tools they need to identify, develop, and retain the best talent in the game. With Deeper Signals, you can accurately assess personality, motivation, and competencies in just 7 minutes. You can generate personalized action plans and development journeys that equip leaders, individuals, and teams with the insights needed to improve onboarding, help them grow, and increase their overall performance. You can take your selection, onboarding, and development processes to the next level with Deeper Signals. And the best part, Deeper Signals is affordable, user-friendly, and scalable, making it accessible to organizations of all sizes. No wonder over 400,000 people from over 140 countries have completed their assessments, and companies like Caterpillar and S&P Global are loyal customers. But don't just take my word for it. You can try Deeper Signals Core Drivers Assessment for yourself. Go to deepersignals.com/futurepod, that's future P-O-D, and take the Core Drivers Assessment for free. It's normally $65 per assessment, but Deeper Signals has agreed to give Future of HR listeners this limited time opportunity to try the assessment risk-free. So what are you waiting for? Go to deepersignals.com/futurepod, P-O-D, and complete the 7-minute Core Drivers Assessment. I know you'll be impressed with the results. And with Deeper Signals, you'll have the scientific, data-driven approach you need to select, onboard, and develop the talent that'll help your organization to win today and into the future. Let's talk more about the future of work, kind of looking forward. And what are some of those key trends you think are going to have the most impact over the next few years and beyond?
Yeah. So I think number one, which is still, you know, hotly debated, is where work is happening. And so before the pandemic, you know, when I look at the numbers in the U.S. anyways, you know, you only had a little less than 6% of the workforce who was truly full-time remote workers. Today, that number is at about 18-19%. So that is a pretty mainstream shift that happened pretty rapidly that we haven't seen from just a work structure perspective. So I think how that's going to be interesting and how it plays out for organizations. You know, we saw in the news, there's many organizations this week alone that have forced employees back in the office 5 days a week. What happens with that talent? Does that talent and high-performing talent actually vote with their feet and go somewhere else? Or does that start to become normalized again? Does remote work become the exception or the rule of how organizations recruit talent? A lot of our research is saying that remote work in particular and having a level of flexibility is one of the number one recruiting mechanisms today to recruit and retain high talent. And so I still think we need a couple more years to see how that's going to play out because it still feels a lot of tension and almost a war today within organizations and how they stand on that. The second thing is we have to continue to talk about AI. I think the pandemic shadowed it for a bit, just in terms of the headlines. But the development of AI, as you and I know, has been around since the 1950s. And so in some ways, AI have never yet really ushered in the promise of productivity and creativity that I think many economists and technologists have been waiting for. We might finally be at that turning point where AI really begins to disrupt workforces beyond just blue-collar work, what we've seen before in the past, and much more of this white-collar work. And so how organizations grapple with that, how we as a society begin to grapple with that when you start disrupting college-educated professionals who may, quite frankly, become increasingly irrelevant without the proper upskilling, that to me is going to be a massive trend we have to unpack. And then finally, you know, I'm at Upwork. We were really thinking and studying a lot around the freelancer model and how freelancing is beginning to become much more mainstream in the U.S. in particular. And so the question is, again, as an HR perspective, how do you start creating those cultures that are inclusive? Today, that freelancer experience is often marked by an in-group, out-group. They come in through procurement. It's really based on what can I not do? What email can I not send? What event can I not invite them to? And I think that has to begin to change as organizations rely more on freelancers for some of the core strategic work that they have to get done.
It's really, really interesting. And a friend of mine I was having a conversation with, he's a head of talent. He was talking about shifting from headcount to cost of labor and starting to think about it differently and trying to get finance and the whole team to think differently because of gig workers, because of contractors, because of consultants they use or vendors, right? And those partners, and it's a bigger ecosystem than just thinking full-time employment, right? Because the companies have started to shift more. And so that's interesting you say that. But let's go back to, you mentioned, you know, there's more demand for jobs, right, than the supply. And that, you know, we have more, workers really have more power than they have. But it doesn't feel like that. You know, we see people who are obviously struggling or looking for roles. What are some of the trends that are kind of, I guess, give you confidence to say that there is less supply but more demand for workers and that will continue in the future?
Yeah. There are a couple different dynamics and nuances to unpack here. For the first time, at least in our modern work history, we have more people exiting and retiring the workforce than we do coming in. And so that alone is creating, you know, I think some academics have called it a silver tsunami, where we just have people who are exiting at almost 5-to-1, the ratio in industries like manufacturing and construction as perfect examples. And so what that alone is creating is our labor supply imbalance, simply because you don't have enough people entering at fast enough rates. And I know it's keeping a lot of HR leaders up at night within that realm is you can't upskill. Who's going to be training the people if they're leaving faster than those who are entering in? And how do you have that knowledge transfer occur in a way where you have potentially so much legacy knowledge being lost within certain industries? The second thing is what we see is Gen Z is actually delaying some of their entry into the workforce and focusing on continuing education and or AI skills training. We're seeing as a reason for some of their delay. And so again, we've seen this is a trend that the millennials had as well, but a little bit of a delay of entry into the workforce and starting at an older age. And then finally, I think what we've seen with AI, which we've seen with any other technology, is a skills-biased technology change, meaning there are going to be a lot of new jobs that are being created because of AI, but the workforce today often doesn't have the skill set that's needed. And so there's a bit of an imbalance of what companies are needing, where we're seeing the openings, and then what skill sets workers currently have. And then the last thing, and I don't have a good answer for this trend, to be fully honest with you, but like the jobs report just came out today. And what we saw is a lot of growth in government, retail, healthcare, really social services. We as a society, I think, have tend to undervalued and really not, their pay wages aren't the same there, but that is where a lot of the demand still is within our society and where the work needs to get done. And so how do we make those jobs more appealing? How do we maybe even balance some of the pay rates that's happening there? Because that is where a lot of the demand is today.
It's a great point to kind of think about the jobs report and really what industries are really growing, which ones are not growing as much, right? I think that's also why sometimes when we see on a local micro level, you feel like there's that demand supply where you're like, oh, I don't see people getting the jobs we think. Well, they just maybe not have the skill set. And so it's always that mismatch of skills and the demand. Talk a little more about leadership, because I know you've talked about thinking about the future, that the notion of leadership has to change in the futures. And just tell us more why you believe that and what should leadership look like as we move into the future?
Yeah. Well, as much as I study the future of work, I've studied a lot of business history. And I've always, like I said, when I'm sitting around that cubicle as a marketer, trying to understand why so much was happening from a leadership perspective that just didn't feel overly human. And it just felt like, you know, quite frankly, leaders can do dumb things when it goes to engaging their talent and interacting. Why is that the case? And so I went on this quest to understand how we ended up here. There's two core assumptions that many people who've got an MBA program who've been trained in management discipline don't realize that it's been built on. The first core assumption, the whole reason why the management discipline exists, is because we don't trust people to do the right thing on behalf of the organization. Academics call this agency costs, but essentially it means you need a manager and leader there to make sure that the workforce is going to act on behalf of the shareholders and do really what's best for the organization. So much when you take that step back, when I ask HR professionals all the time is, do you trust your workforce? As a leader, do you trust people are going to do the right thing? Because most of the time, the answer deep down is no. And that really leads us to have carrots and sticks models, hierarchical forms of leadership, and really just this issue of distrust from the get-go. The second thing that a lot of people don't realize is, again, management has formed an assumption that the sole purpose of business is to maximize shareholder value. And so what that does is a hyper-focus on how do we drive quarterly returns every quarter. as opposed to more of a stakeholder theory, which again, I think is getting more lip service out there, especially at Davos and so forth. However, I think in practice, many leaders in organizations are still wired for shareholder wealth maximization. And so what happens, Mars is a company, actually I studied quite a bit. It was a great example of how much shareholder wealth is enough and where do we actually begin to optimize across all of our stakeholders in terms of, you know, really all those boats rising as a result of the organization. So that's why I so strongly believe that leadership needs to change today. And it needs to start from a position of, I trust my workers want to work. I trust that they're going to do the right thing on behalf of the organization. How do I, as a leader, facilitate those right conditions so that they're growing and developing and continue to give greater contributions? It's a nuanced shift in perspective and assumption, but I actually think it makes all the difference in the way that people lead today.
Yeah, I think you're right. And it really does come down to trust. And even these mandates of 5 days back in the office, you know, where's the trust there?
100%.
And so I think there's organizations that are embracing more flexibility there. They're, you know, relying on that. But it is difficult because we are short-term focused, right? You know, we're looking at the next quarter. We're, you know, we're measured on that. We're going to be rewarded on our bonuses by that or by stock, to your point. And so the systems has to change in terms of rewards, right? And I think the other thing I've also, I just haven't seen an organization do this yet, but we need to do this, is move to team-based rewards. I mean, nothing is, I know I got a performance rating, and maybe I was amazing, maybe I was average, I don't know. But the reality is a team is what got the work done. And so we talk about teams, we look at project teams, we do our work in project teams, but we don't reward that team. We don't have end-of-year performance reviews and say, well, how did JP and Kelly interact and deliver a product? It was, well, how did Kelly do or how did JP do? And I think that's a huge miss. And I think for our field, we need to unlock this. I don't know if you have thoughts on that, but.
JP, I think it's a brilliant point, to be quite frank. And you know, one of the companies that I've actually seen pivot to more team-based performance management is Microsoft. So, you know, Microsoft had this last decade of stockholder returns and performance. And they were wired performance management, as majority of organizations are, towards that individualized focus. To your point, JP, what's your outputs? What did you deliver? And then you're going to be rewarded based on that. You and I both know, and I'm sure everyone who's listening to this podcast knows, that is not how work is conducted today. We are not on assembly line anymore, having a very individualized task that really is isolated. Any work that's happening today is interdependent and absolutely happening at a team level, not an individual level. And so Microsoft made a difference in their performance about 10 years ago, where they started asking the question that managers were going to rate their employees on, which was, how did this person's contribution make others around them better? And it became this much more, how are you developing others around you, as opposed to what have you done for me lately as an individual? And that dynamic changed everything in the way that teams began to operationalize. Because you and I both know, as human behavior, we're going to just go with where the reward is. You know, we're going to have the least amount of friction. We're going to go with, if we're incentivized to be individualistic and competitive, that's how we're going to behave. If we're incentivized to be cooperative and collaborative and actually start becoming developers of others, we're going to do that. I mean, that's actually more human, quite frankly, and innate in us than anything else. And so I do, anytime I get the opportunity to encourage HR professionals, where is that question, your performance management system? Doesn't mean 100% has to be towards team-based performance, but at least 50% around, how are those individuals making others around them better? How are they making the system better? I think that really becomes transformative and changes everything within an organization today.
Kelly, it's such a brilliant point. And I'm so glad I asked that question, because you went to a place I didn't know you were going to go. And I love that, because when you go help somebody else, right, when you help them grow, contribute, right, make their work or job easier, what do? You build trust. And that is the foundation of that, right? Because you're helping others. When you're helping others, everything gets easier. It's really the secret to life, is like, give more value than you get. And you're going to have a great life. People are going to like you. People are going to be like, want to give you opportunities and reciprocate. And so many people don't get that, because they come from, really think about the world from not abundance, right? But a limited resources. And so I've got to hold this and you know, withhold things from you, versus I want to be abundant. Hey, I can help you. We can both win. And so I love that. That's a great question that honestly I haven't put into my performance reviews, but I will think about going forward as I put this to practice. All right. Now we come for our very... Now we come to our controversial time for the podcast. So just everyone hold on.
Let's go.
We're going to talk about skills-based organizations, which is a super hot topic. Ooh. And I have some opinions on, but I'm going to try to hold off because I want to know your opinions. But there's just a lot of talk on skills-based organizations, skills-based hiring, you know, learning development. But from your research, what's the promise of this, and what are some of the obstacles to making it happen?
Yeah, I think it's a really hot topic right now. I don't know if you saw, the state of Massachusetts actually just went to a skills-based hiring approach where they removed all educational requirements. So they're like actually at the public level and they're asking private companies to follow suit. So definitely a story for all those who are listening to the podcast to watch and follow and see the, you know, success of that. So skills-based organizations, I think, are stuck in theory right now, if I'm going to be honest with you. I buy the theory of it, and there's this great academic work that's happening. Those of us in HR have been trained in person role fit, person organization fit. Well, there's a new theory emerging within the academic literature that's saying person skill fit. How do we begin to identify the skills we need within our organizations and then go find the talent with those skills and match that and making that the actual point in unit of analysis as opposed to a role itself? I've read the book, you know, by Dr. Boudreau that's talked about work without jobs and how, again, our unit of analysis has been around jobs and really less the work. I actually have a paper coming out soon that really goes through from a practical perspective of how does that actually manifest itself within an organization? Because it's really hard to have a skills-based organization when our unit of analysis is still centered around a job. We hire towards a job. We performance manage towards a job. We think about work, conducting work through a job. Now, I'm going to tell you the postcards of where I think I'm going to go. From a taxification perspective, where you really begin to break down and deconstruct the job into the tasks that are required and the skills that are required, you get to make that visible. I think that's an exciting way to really think about work and allow people much more agility. And again, team-focused work, project-based work, it's the Hollywood model that I think a lot of HR professionals have talked about before. You bring together the best of the best to create something, dissemble, and recreate. I think my concern with that, and the one caution I would have to HR organizations who are doing this, is making sure we don't go back to industrial era, where people become so specialized and so focused on one particular task within the organization that they lose sight of the bigger picture. And, you know, I've said a lot around what constitutes meaningful work. It's being able to see the big picture and realizing how your contribution makes a difference. And so I think that's going to be a bit of a tension we're going to have to grapple with as we start to testify jobs. And maybe jobs in the next 5 to 7 years isn't the way that we think about organizations and the flow of work within talent, but instead much more around this testified approach. Because again, this allows us to see where AI becomes meaningful. I use an example of me myself as a researcher. The majority of my job is actually not research, as much as I want it to be. It's around stakeholder management. It's around connecting with other teams and, you know, engaging in listening exercises. It's onboarding research vendors. It's measuring their performance. It's analyzing data. When I begin to break all those tasks down, I can clearly see where I want to outsource those tasks to AI and where I might be able to outsource to a freelancer or have a vendor come in and help. But again, I have to make sure I'm not doing it in such a way that it actually belittles and takes away the meaning for my role. So I think it's going to be interesting to see. I'm just worried it's a bit stuck in theoretical world as opposed to discipline, but I'd be curious to know what your thoughts are on that topic.
Well, I think you've really hit a lot of the key factors. And I think the theoretical piece is interesting. When I kind of think about the skills piece, the risk we have, to your point, of over-rotating on this idea. Because when I think about the locus of control of like who's responsible for the skill and the job to be done. And so I understand, like when you think about, we think about critical experiences or here's the results I'm expecting this person to deliver in this job, you know, and you move to the skills, it's a radically different way to think about it. And so now if I break down the skills, there's still a business process or something that has to get done end to end. So it's usually a collection of experiences or skills that come together. And so where I kind of start to, this, my mind starts to meld a little bit, like this is a big shift, is how you really map this out. And I think you can do it in small spot, you know, small areas and spots. I think it's hard to go to an entire skills-based organization like some vendors are pushing. I think you've got to be really smart and narrow and focused where you believe you can deliver some value and this would have implications. The second thing I was thinking a little bit more is, so I say I'm good at this and I've got these skills. How do you validate it, right? I mean, LinkedIn asked my skills. I don't know. I mean, and people, I'm not even sure the whole skills thing in LinkedIn is very funny because people would actually recommend you and say you did it. Well, that's great. I've got some internal external validation on some skills. But how do you do that internally? And how do you then decide who gets a job based on a skill when we don't have assessments for the skills? It's valid and objective. So I think there's some barriers to it a little bit. I do think skills-based organizations or tools like talent intelligence and talent marketplace tools have a great benefit from a career development standpoint and helping people think about how they can change and grow and evolve their skill set. But I'm not sure that I've seen someone do this in hiring yet in a way, even though I will go look at one you mentioned already. So that's going to be interesting to see. So that's my take on it. I think the jury is very much out. But I am someone who doesn't love the hype in HR, and there's always a bright, shiny object. And so I always challenge all HR practitioners and myself to really be critical thinkers and say, how is this really going to work? And is this really something that's new and different, or is it old wine and new bottle? Is this competencies 2.0? You know, we can have that debate, but that type of stuff.
Yeah. Well, and I think you bring a great point, because I think when I was looking at the Massachusetts legislation where they've changed the skills-based hiring, we always have like an unintended consequences that occurs when we shift from one model to another. And so I think one of the questions I have that I don't have an answer to, quite frankly, yet is whether education is right or wrong, it becomes at least a mark or barometer to help weed out all the talent and also just make an HR professional's life doable. And so we can, you know, obviously, I think part of the downfall of that, there's been lots of research that we've weeded out talent inappropriately at times because of that. But without having that yardstick or some sort of credential, to your point, that says, hey, you know, at least you went through this 4 years, we're going to assume you've developed XYZ because you've been granted a degree. What becomes that new mark, to your point, you know, and how do you now really take a universe that, you know, any job today gets thousands of applications on? What becomes that filter? Because we need a filter. We're humans. We can't look at 1,000 resumes for every job. And so I think that's where I'm a little concerned, is I don't know what that substitute is yet from education to skill. And to your point, is it self-reported? Because you and I both know that that could be a dangerous metric as well. So that's what I'm looking to see, is what's that new metric we're going to use to actually operationalize skills-based hiring.
It's going to be really interesting to see what happens over the next 3 to 5 years. And if we say that was a fad, didn't work, or we unlock it in a way that really is actionable and adds value to the business. Because that's the other piece that I'll just make, and then I'm going to get off this soapbox. So I don't usually talk this much in the podcast. I just don't think many CEOs are asking for skills-based organizations. I think they're asking for to grow the business. They're asking to cut costs or maximize costs and increase margins. Yep. And deal with competitive environmental factors. I think HR is now saying, hey, is skills-based a way to get there? If it is, great. If it's not, then it may or may not be on my priority list for 2024 or beyond. That's how I think about it.
I think you're spot on. It needs to be the means, not the end. To your point, I think too often it's becoming the end on HR roadmap and not the means to solving whatever the business problem is that the CEO is indeed asking for.
Wow, we got through that. Thank you for that great conversation, Kelly. That was fun. That was the most controversial part. Let's talk more about AI, because I know you really understand this. And I think a lot of people are still learning what AI is and the impact. But, you know, the International Monetary Fund recently came out and said that a report that AI will impact up to 40% of all jobs. And we talked about this a little bit, but how do you think about upskilling both blue collar and knowledge workers with generative AI in mind? What should organizations be doing?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. So I think, you know, we'll start with the blue collar side of work. What I'm seeing, at least within the data, is that the skill set is moving from a true physical skill set into this blurring and blending of physical and digital. And so I think you're going to see an infusion of digital skills required from trades that otherwise weren't really built with digital in mind, whether that's manufacturing, plumbing, construction. The ability to use AI, and it's not just AI, it's also run when we think about the blue collar skill work, it's Internet of Things. It's the ability of sensors to get smarter and really, again, display some of the location of the work. It's using augmented reality to diagnose and see something that may otherwise not be seen. And so the host of digital technologies that are now available to that those trades, I think is tremendous. And I actually think it's going to offer a lot of opportunity there. And again, what we've seen with skills bias technology changes actually increases wages as these individuals have to learn to work alongside these technologies. And so I'm fairly optimistic. And then when it comes to AI, I think we're going to see much less disruption and actually much more leveling up and the ability to, again, gain wages there. Now, where I am concerned is that when we start moving over to knowledge work, which again has traditionally been somewhat safe outside of maybe robotic process automation, we haven't necessarily seen that same level of disruption. And you're absolutely right. The report focuses a lot on that 40% disruption, really primarily in white-collared work. And so today, what we're seeing in our Upwork platform, and we're seeing this in real time because we can see the whole labor market happening. And what we're seeing is individuals that are working alongside AI and highly complex, more value-add tasks are now. They're higher in demand and they're getting more wages than anything we've seen before in our platform. We are beginning to see that substitution effect take place for that low value repetitive routine work. I think this is something that's been talked about for a long time, to be honest with you, that we thought was going to happen. And this is why I actually do think we're in the era where this is going to become a reality. And so my plea is, at an individual level, if you're engaged in work that's low skilled, and what we mean by that is low, it's routine based. It's not necessarily working alongside a technology today. It's very administrative in nature. That is going to require a pivot. And so that is where the upskilling journey has to take place. In organizations, my appeal to leaders is, if you have a workforce that's comprised today of human labor that's mostly doing administrative tasks, we can see the writing on the wall. A lot of that's going to shift over to AI. And so the question becomes, how do you begin to move those workers higher up on the value chain? How do you begin to engage them in more complex thinking, strategic thinking, creativity? That's going to be a tall order. And the only way that I can foresee this happening is we have to clear the runways within organizations and make more time for learning. You know, Burson's talked a lot about that in his research. And Jory, I think one of his studies said like 4 minutes is the average weekly time that employees spend towards learning. And so how do we ensure that our employees are learning at rates and having that time and growth to develop as part of their core job, as opposed to something that they have to go do on the side? Because that's where I worry people won't have the time and attention to really do the upskilling they need to remain, employed in the future.
It's fascinating how that's going to impact us. And I think, you know, you just hit so many good points for HR teams to be thinking through. How do we upskill? How do we have time for this? And how do we figure out what generative AI is? What does that mean for our organization? And how do we start to then figure out how that can that apply? Because it can be something that makes your job a lot better, I think, right? It could be a productivity machine. And I mean, I would love to have an AI co-pilot that handled my calendar and did dinner reservations and like took away a lot of these easy tasks that like take a lot of time that are more administrative, right? So that sounds exciting and it would push us to have to do higher value work. But I think the question is, how do we get people prepared to do that and have organizations to think that way? And that's going to be another big mindset shift over the next, you know, 5 to 10 years. 100%. Kelly, last question for you.
Okay.
What is one word or phrase that you believe will define the future of HR over the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, I'm going to double down and say job disruption. I think job disruption has to continue to take place. And to your point, whether that's necessarily moving us to a skills biased or skills organization, TBD, but something is broken in the way that we organize work today and the way that we think about work. I think we can probably all agree on that, both from an HR perspective, from a workforce perspective. And so how do we really begin to reimagine the mechanics of the job? What is the right cadence of bringing people together, of having them work at home? What's the right cadence of hours? You know, there's all this talk about a 4-day work week. Is that the future? Hard to say. But regardless, everything that I can summarize that I see happening in the future of work perspective is really about the way we organize work. And I think the job has to be disrupted today.
Kelly, job disruption makes a lot of sense. Thank you so much for being on the Future of HR podcast. You rocked it. We learned a lot. Thank you.
Thank you so much, JP.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Future of HR podcast. Thanks again to Kelly for sharing her perspectives and research on the future of work. As always, you can go to futureofhr.com to view all of our past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. If you enjoyed this episode of Future of HR, be sure to subscribe and share our podcast with at least one other person, or even better, leave a review on Apple or Spotify podcasts. This really helps us to grow the podcast and helps with our mission of inspiring the next generation of HR leaders. We'll be back next week with Sandy Ogg and Hein Nappen. Sandy is the founder of CEO Works, a consulting firm specializing in leadership and talent consulting. And from 2011 to 2016, Sandy worked as the operating partner in private equity at the Blackstone Group, serving Blackstone's nearly 100 portfolio companies. And prior to Blackstone, he was the chief human resources officer for Unilever. Sandy's also been inducted as a fellow by the National Academy of Human Resources, which is the highest honor in our profession. Joining Sandy will be Hein. Hein is a managing partner for Europe for CEO Works. And prior to joining CEO Works, Hein served as a CHRO for ING Bank in Amsterdam, where he is responsible for the company-wide people strategy for over 53,000 employees across 45 countries. Sandy, Hein, and I will be talking about how to connect talent to value, why CEO and CHROs need to focus on the very few things that really do create value, and why they use the term click to describe the process of putting the right talent in the right roles to deliver value, and much, much more. This is an insightful conversation on talent and one you won't want to miss.
Thanks again for listening to the Future of HR and being part of our community.